Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 121, Buddhism 101, Defining the Buddha's Inner and Cool Revolutions.
Inner revolution is the work of the Buddha, as I understood it. And because he's thought of as a religious founder, a prophet, or a holy man or something like that, and I am presenting him as a revolutionary, someone who transforms society as well as transforming his inner mind. But then I call it inner revolution, or sometimes in the book itself I call it a cool revolution, to distinguish it from a hot revolution or a material revolution, which we've seen a lot of in the last few centuries, where people overthrow a government violently, and then unfortunately often the overthrowers become more oppressive when they become the government because they came there by violence. So in a way we're kind of tired of hot revolutions, but the cool revolution has been going on for thousands of years since the Axial Age when the Buddha lived. And it's a slow social change occasioned by education, and by people changing their sensibility, their level of understanding, their wisdom, their ethical being and comportment, bit by bit. And that is what sort of the Buddha launched in the world in India 2,500 years ago or so, and is now reaching actually the West. Last century or so has been reaching the West, and reached all over Asia in the past.
Is this
so that's sort of what I'm calling the inner revolution.
Right. Well, it sounds like the way you present it, this is really across the planet. I mean, I think that
perhaps
teachers like Socrates, perhaps Jesus,
true.
Abraham, Moses, the Judaic tradition, Lao Tzu,
yes.
They are not all concerned with some kind of profound...
Absolutely. I adopt the concept of the biologist Rupert Sheldrake, who talks about morphogenetic resonance,
yes.
Or sometimes morphic resonance.
He's been on our show earlier, yes.
Right. Rupert has been here. Oh, no. Well, I adopt his concept by the idea that during the Axial Age, you know, the pre-Socratics, Zoroaster, Buddha, Deutero, Isaiah, Lao Tzu and Confucius were morphically resonating with each other, plus other, of course, wise men in India like Mahavira and the Yajnavalkya and others. And they were making this similar breakthrough, which was the breakthrough of bringing out the human individual's potential, of developing the inner being and so on, and challenging the coercive powers of the kings of the day, you know, based on, you know, Toynbee and Karl Jaspers' thesis of the Axial Age connected to that.
Right.
But I see that in different phase times in history, actually, at the time of the Tang Dynasty and the Charlemagne and the Pala dynasties in India, then later again in the medieval period, post-medieval period, the Renaissance time, I see these similar things. And the wonderful thing about our age in the 20th and 21st century is that this resonating process, which is global, worldwide, is now, we're conscious of it because it's connected now by electronics and other things. But it was always connected. It was connected just in the medium of the mind, it was connected.
And in the morphic field.
In the morphic field, that's right.
Which is somehow we're in that unified space.
Yes. Alex Elliott, my friend, had the concept of the mythosphere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sort of the paradigmosphere, you could say, that was circling the globe. You know, we don't know exactly what was going on in sub-Saharan Africa and in the Americas in those days, but probably similar things were taking place, actually.
Well, what you see across the planet in that Axial Age is that the great spiritual geniuses, so to speak, were all seeing some primal reality, some fundamental field that's deeper
yes.
than the everyday diversity.
Yes.
That there's a unifying source, whether it's we call the Tao or the Om or
yes.
Shunyata or Yahweh,
right.
Allah.
I think
name,
so.
You think that they're all trying to zero in on some fundamental primal...
Yeah. Well, I think the main thing was the breaking through of the individual's ability to become enlightened in some sense,
mm-hmm.
to really realize their full human potential. Yeah. I think that was really what it was. Before that, everywhere in Eurasia and probably worldwide, people were more or less part of their collective. They did their duty, they filled their space, and then they died, and then they were sort of recycled. They had a kind of feeling of being part of nature. And in this period, I think the individual emerged, and people began to realize that the human individual had this unlimited potential internally to develop and awaken these various higher faculties, evolve into being a higher being. I think that's really the common thread. In the more theistic societies, I think the people who were thought of as super mystics were not so well tolerated, because the kings wanted everybody's labor. They didn't want people going off and developing their potential. They wanted them working for them. So in West Asia and in East Asia, they were a little bit behind. India was the great source, I think, of all of this, because they were a wealthier economy. The kings could allow surplus people to wander around and to try to seek enlightenment. It didn't really bother them because they had so much surplus. Mm-hmm. So it isn't a racial thing, I think, it's just an economic thing. The alluvia of the Indus and the Ganges valleys were so richer than everywhere else that and the climate was better and enabled people to do that, I think.
What is the key to the inner revolution? You know what outer revolutions you think.
Right, right.
One might think that this great inner revolution, however we understand it, which is going to awaken the person to his her true human potential, will have enormous consequences for the culture at large.
Yes.
Externally too.
Absolutely.
So what is the turning point of the inner revolution?
Well, I think the turning point there is that Buddha, it's exemplified in the Buddha's story, where he was supposed to be a king and conquer the world because that was his caste duty. That was what his class did. That's what his father did. He was supposed to just do that. That was his service. And instead he said, no, I don't want to do that. What's the point of conquering the world if I have not conquered myself, if I don't understand what the world is? So he rebelled against that, and he went off and to discover the nature of the world, and he succeeded and did discover the nature of the world, according to the view of millions of people who have followed him since. And he provided, also as witnessed by the fact that he left a method whereby other people could also discover the nature of their mind and the nature of their world. And this had these five principles, I call them. He discovered the transcendent value of the individual's fulfillment. He discovered, because of the value of the individual, that people should not be violent and human life should not be wasted, either one's own or another's. He discovered that the human being had infinite learning potential, so education should be the purpose of life, evolutionary education, not just some surface education. He discovered that every human being had extreme intrinsic value, so society should support their individuals, whether they were able to produce anything for them or not, the kind of social altruism. And finally, he discovered that all beings were equal, that is to say, it didn't matter what class you were born in, whatever, you had the ability to become enlightened, whether you were an untouchable or a Brahmin or a warrior or a merchant. It didn't matter. And so these five principles then unleashed this inner revolution that spread throughout the world, I believe. And today we can say truly it is global.
Just going fast forward, but I'd like to come back again.
Yes.
If this is over millennia has been evolving on the planet,
yes,
this inner revolution,
yes,
people feel that in the 21st century we've reached a kind of critical moment.
Absolutely.
Many people are speaking about shift times or
yes,
global shift, mind shift.
Yes,
2012.
Yes. Absolutely.
Does this resonate with you? I mean, in terms of the themes of your book.
Yes, well, now is the time. Now is the time when the inner revolution has to become fully mainstream cultural.
Why?
Because without it, we will be doomed. If we don't really put the individual first, and if we don't put nonviolence first, and if we don't really develop our knowledge of the real nature of life and therefore the value of other beings, so that we don't then harm them and so forth, and we put a stop to war, if we don't put a stop to war and militarism now. In the past, there were many who were working on this inner revolution. You know, in many different societies would reach different ages and different flowerings, like renaissances and things at different times, but then some other one would come in and beat them up, and they would sort of go backwards, and there'd be a war and all this, and that has happened up to now. But now we've reached a point where the inner revolution has released so much human genius, we have created so much technology, that the quality of our inner mind is magnified by machinery so hugely that if we leave the world in the hands of people who are unself-controlled, ignorant, angry, greedy, they will destroy the entire planet and themselves. So now, finally, we've reached that point. I think that Jesus meant when Jesus would be back, he better come back, or that would be the end of it for people. And Buddha never said that he would come back. Of course, he said he never left, actually, the Buddha. And it's time when people actually realize this. I mean, Jesus said, love thine enemy. Buddha said, violence will never produce anything, and everyone has the ability to attain freedom from suffering. It's now people time that for people to really do that, actually. Or no longer can we survive. You know, we're finished. The human species will be finished.
We're in the 11th hour.
In a short time. We're in the 11th hour and 59 minutes, so to speak, you know. And it's time to wake up. People have to wake up.
Bob, is there a science behind this? Is this a matter of, it sounds as if we don't, we're going to be hit a kind of disaster and our survival is at stake. But I think people may want to know, I mean, is there something in this revolution that's grounded in reality? In that sense of science, not science as we know it, but spiritual science.
Yeah, it is science. Well, it is science as we know it, but it's just science as we know it has been too dogmatically involved with materialism. But actually, its own sophisticated approach to materialism has liberated it, but the most scientists haven't caught up with that. The 21st century physics has discovered that they don't know what matter is. That matter dissolves under analysis into pure waves and pure light, and nobody knows what it is. So therefore, now they have to really pay attention and take responsibility for the mind of the observer. The human mind, the subjectivity, becomes part of nature, rather than a pretense that there is no mind in nature and it's all just objective fact that somehow some machines are reading. We now have to take responsibility for our own mind, our own ethics, our own decisions, and we can no longer just act mechanically. So this is sort of, we've painted ourselves, let's say, into a corner where we now have to really see the light. Or else, as President Johnson used to say, if we don't see the light, we know we're going to feel the heat.
I'd like to pursue that in a number of ways, because infinite life, the topic infinite life is intriguing, because most of us in everyday culture, you know, whatever we believe about the infinite, don't think of ourselves as touching infinite life.
Right.
And I think you're trying to bring that out in your book.
Yes, that's a very primary tenet in Buddha's teaching, which is that there is no way something can ever come from nothing. And furthermore, no something can ever become nothing. It's like a misuse of language to use such expression. Mm-hmm. Because nothing, newsflash, nothing is nothing. It's not a place you can go to or come from. And therefore, something always produces something else. Everything observed in nature is a continuum. And so why should our minds, the individual mind, be other than a continuum? Mm-hmm. Buddha had this experience under the tree before his full enlightenment, where he remembered his infinite previous lives. And then he saw and became aware of all the previous lives of other beings, and he saw their future destinies, it is said, I mean, traditionally. So he suddenly saw everything as an ocean of infinite life, and the different beings as part of this continuum. And then he became fully enlightened, and he himself became completely free, and he saw that others could also do so. And so this is, I feel, a very critical thing that we have to do. Now, religious people a little bit have this. For example, the Hindus, the Taoists, they feel they are continua, that are part of a nature that goes on. And there's no foreseeable end, and there should be no particular beginning, because there's a beginning, first beginning would mean something out of nothing. The theists in the West, the Abrahamics, at the time of Jesus, actually, and Isaiah, reincarnation, transmigration, as they call it, was commonplace knowledge in the Mediterranean. But after Constantine in the 4th century, it was banned in Christianity. So the theists say that there was nothing before you're born, but then you have an infinite eternal future life, one way or the other, you know, very much depends on God. But if you analyze that, what does it mean, nothing before you were born? Because your soul is created by God. God has infinitely existed in the past. Presumably, he knew about your soul, therefore infinitely. So in a way, you existed infinitely within God in the past. You can sort of say that with Christians, who, even though they've banned the idea of reincarnation. But the key point about it is that when you adopt, when you break free of what I call the terminal lifestyle, which is like we're living just this one life, we've got to get it all done here, and then luckily, no matter how bad we may be here or how much we may make a mess, we're just out of it when we die. We're gone. That's what I call that, the terminal lifestyle. So you're living like a terminal life. But if you break free of the terminal lifestyle and you begin to get into the infinite lifestyle, then you suddenly, everything changes. For example, in the terminal lifestyle, under that thing, you and I may never see each other again. It's the last time we'll ever talk. I don't have to try to be as significant as I can in every moment with you. But if it's the infinite lifestyle, you and I are going to keep meeting like this, life after life after life, endlessly. Therefore, there is nothing for it, but when we have a moment together, whatever can be done to contribute to your freedom from suffering and my own freedom from suffering, that has to be done. So the moment expands, actually, and contains the seeds of an infinite quality of existence. And also, because we've been in the infinite past, we've already done everything together. And so this time that we have here now is of massive significance. We've each earned this moment. We are at the sort of like, you know, like a little, like an optic piece of optical fiber. We're a little node at the tip of an infinite optical fiber that has had huge messages in it. And so this moment has enormous significance in that light. In a way, the moment becomes infinite. I object a little bit sometimes, not object, but I'm not satisfied with various teachers who teach about how you have to only be in the moment. Because in a materialist society, what does the moment come down to? People's picture of the moment, in a way, is a little bit nihilistic.
Right.
It's a moment that's disconnected from causality, because after all, if we died right now, we'd be nothing as far as a materialist goes. But in the infinite life cycle, we wouldn't be nothing. If we died, we'd just be changing body, and the quality of our mind would determine how we would come to a new body. And therefore, the quality of our mind in this moment has infinite impact. So I just feel it's really, really critical, and that is the case in Buddhism, does feel that, that we have this infinite time frame. And, you know, like my editor hated the title. She said, how could you do that? Infinite life, and many arguments made. And finally, at one point, she said, well, now, Bob, you don't want to go around promising people infinite life, do you? And so I said, no, I want to threaten them with infinite life. Because if life is infinite, then what you do now has infinite consequence. So therefore, it has to be better than worse. Because even a tiny increment toward the better will have an infinite betterness about it. So there's no, even though you want to be in the moment, but the moment has infinite, is pregnant with infinite happiness or negativity. So you want it to be happiness. And therefore you become much more vibrant and much more alive in the moment. Because it has this consequence, it's connected to everything.
Well, I think the process that, I mean, again, in a global way, I mean, so many of our great teachers saw that when you're in the ego mind, which separates itself,
yes,
interconnectivity.
That's right.
That apparently is a source of suffering.
Yes.
But if we can touch the unified field,
yes,
that's there,
yes,
it is infinite.
That's true.
And that, to become a real human is to surf the infinite.
That's right.
Field, so that there's a lot of company in that vision. Of
absolutely, it is. Modern science is coming to that actually through its law of thermodynamics that no energy is ever lost in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And so, why should our mind's energy be the one thing that is lost? It doesn't make any sense.
But if you follow this logic, just think for a moment, because
yes,
if you think of ourselves in an ego privileged way, in a linear way, if you think of future lives, past lives, you think of it more from that lens of the ego.
Okay.
But if we make the switch into the infinite space that you're speaking of,
yeah,
we have to step out of that lens,
yeah,
that limited lens.
Yeah.
But then, isn't it the case that you and I are connected in our lives now? It's not only,
yes,
that my past lives, all the lives are connected.
Of there. Course.
So that
of
there's
course.
A way in which if you could process that powerful moment.
Absolutely. Well, also, of course, even the ego is connected. If we reduce the ego to its proper role, it's the Greek first-person pronoun. You know, in German, Freud never used the word ego. He used the word ich, which is just I.
Yes.
And so the ego is useful when it is our tool. When we are the tool of some sort of reified ego, then we are helpless. We are a victim. So even the ego is interconnected with everything. But there's no end, no nothing that's not connected.
Well, that makes the idea of, you know, prior lives, future lives, other lives right now are much more palatable and user-friendly.
Oh, that's good.
If that's true, because...
No, more power to that.
No, but isn't the Buddha... I mean, the earlier, as the teaching of Buddha emerges, I understand that the Buddha, you might think of the Buddha as a Buddha on the mountain enlightened by himself, herself.
Yeah.
But when you realize that the Buddha's insight was interconnectivity of all things,
yeah,
then the suffering of the people is,
yeah,
part of the Buddha.
Oh, absolutely.
So the Buddha cannot separate...
That's right. And, well, the Buddha, in order to become a Buddha... under the Bodhi tree.
Yeah.
What the Buddha had, this is something that I use a lot nowadays, because people often ask me, well, you've been studying for 45 years Buddhism, aren't you enlightened? And I always have to say, no, I'm not. I'm maybe a little more enlightened than I was, because I was so awfully stupid, but I'm still not enlightened. And then they get terribly upset and threatened, and they think, well, gee, if you didn't get enlightened after all this, there's no hope for us, and it's useless, and all this. So I tell them, well, I have a consolation, though. I have a consolation prize. And so what is the consolation, they then ask me. And then I tell them that this is, that relates to the Buddha attaining enlightenment. Buddha had a vow as a bodhisattva that he would never become enlightened and attain nirvana and freedom from suffering. And you have to attain nirvana to become enlightened. Until all beings were free of suffering. So wait, where did he go? I'm still suffering. But he said he couldn't attain Buddhahood until I was free of suffering. So what did until mean for the Buddha? In order to become Buddha without breaking his vow, he had to become present not only in all other beings and all elements of space, but also in all periods of time. Mm-hmm. So he had to see my freedom from suffering, my enlightenment, as real to him, as that moment that he was in 2,500 years ago when I was in a previous life. Maybe I was a mouse under the tree there, like squeaking next to him, who knows? But he had to see me as an enlightened, free person in order to do that. And not only that, but since the future is not fixed, he had to commit to have his energy present, because his energy became infinite, of course, at upon enlightenment, to be present, to see to it, to help me make all the proper turns in evolution, to maximize and optimize and make as quickly as possible my progress toward enlightenment. Mm-hmm. So the Buddha's energy is, according to the Buddhist, because of this, is around us all the time, nudging us all toward enlightenment. Mm-hmm. Now, that's one of the consolations. That makes me feel happy, because I don't feel a lack of the presence of the Buddha. Mm-hmm. I realize that it's my ignorance, and actually Buddha must be there, around. Although not being omnipotent, he can't force me to be enlightened, but he's doing everything possible to make it happen, so I have the best possible help. But now, the second consolation, the most important one, is this. When I become enlightened, or when you become enlightened, that means we realize nirvana. But the teaching is that this right now is nirvana. We're in it right now. But I don't experience that. Instead, I think I'm talking to a show, you know, struggling, going to take a train later, dealing, trying to think, say something, whatever, you know. I don't feel like I'm in nirvana, whatever I imagine nirvana to be. But actually, I know that logically I'm supposed to be. This is nirvana. The true reality of this is nirvana. So that means that when I do attain nirvana, someday, some lifetime, it will be one of those things that you know that when you learn it, you realize you always knew it. You will realize that it was here now. You follow me?
Yes.
So that means that I will revise my experience of this moment then.
Yes.
And at that time there will be no difference between this moment and my nirvana moment. Mm-hmm. So that means that we will enjoy this moment together as nirvana retroactively. And that's my consolation.
It's a wonderful consolation.
It is nice. It's logical.
Yes, it is quite logical. I mean, that's what I mean, the science of it, of interconnectivity, it really follows. And there's a consensus of that in global wisdom. But people are terrified of facing the infinite.
The infinite.
I mean, you say that the infinite life is present to us.
Yes.
And that life is bliss.
Yes.
And for the everyday person living in the ego space.
Well, I know, but that's just the concept that they have.
Yes, but
that's just a concept that they have. The point is, you can't face the infinite because you are infinite. Mm-hmm. Is the point? Like infinity couldn't be excluded from you, as a feeling like a finite being. Because if it was, it wouldn't be infinite. Mm-hmm. It would be limited from some place. Mm-hmm. So the finite is all the infinite, right? The infinite has to permeate the finite. The finite is just, the infinite is like the screen on which the finite is projected. It's like the mirror within which the finite is reflected.
Right.
Just like nirvana is the mirror in which this relational world of samsara is reflected. So you can't escape the infinite because it's everywhere, right? So they don't have to worry about facing it. They are it. They have to face other relevant things. And that people are also worried about that because they're always afraid some negative relative thing is going to show up.
Well, let me put it this way. I mean, given that our great teachers have been teaching something like this across the planet, why has it been so difficult for humans to get this? Why are we so stubborn about it? Whether it's stubborn or foolish or recalcitrant or phobic. I wonder if there's a fear of letting go of the ego. We get a warning across the borders of all of our wisdom traditions.
Right.
Arjuna is facing it with Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. The Buddha is realizing that to let go of your ego is almost like facing a death of a kind.
Right.
It's really all across is there a phobia there?
I think so. Well, the Buddha's analysis of it is that we are generally paranoid because of our misapprehension of our own nature. We absolutize a core being in ourselves that is absolutely separate from everything else. Mm-hmm. And once we're in that situation of being our little us versus everything else, and even thinking of the infinite as something outside of ourselves, then naturally it seems to be like infinitely oppressive to us. Temporarily, maybe we can be king or a billionaire or a president or something, and we might think, well, we got things under control. Or even from the Buddhist point of view, we might become a god even, and then feel we've got our local universe under control. But even a god is still not infinite. from Buddha's point of view, because it's still a created being. It has causes that created this garden. And so because of that misapprehension that there's something about us that is absolutely separate from everything else, we then become antagonistic toward everything else and we perceive it as antagonistic to us, and therefore we are afraid of things. So although Buddha and Jesus told us the kingdom of God is within you, this is actually nirvana if you would understand, my body is everywhere and bliss and freedom is your substance really, it's what you are, you're a formulation, you're a configuration of that, we can't bear to hear it because we are clinging on to this instinctive core that we have wrongly constructed. And so when we see through that in a way, that's also an infinite stress because in a way there is no such core. So we're always trying to reconstruct it. We're always trying to make it. And yet there's nothing there to hold it, so it keeps collapsing.
It's unsustainable, isn't it? Yeah.
We have to keep fabricating, and it's terribly stressful. Yeah. At the end of a 13-hour day, we pass out and have to sleep because we're maintaining our world all the time. You know, we're like a television set that's constantly refreshing the screen. Because in fact, we are simply an interrelated element in an infinite sea of interrelativity. Mm-hmm. And if we knew that and we could flow with that, we would actually relax and be happy. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think we are doing that more. However, the skill and liberative technique or liberative art of the enlightened beings is such that I believe they are surrounding us with pedagogic events and with technologies and with knowledge and with textual scriptures and manifestations and religions and whatever, all the great teachers of humanity and the gods and everything, and they are leading us toward an awakening in this light, you know? And I believe we'll reach there. I think people distortedly understand that, like for example, some of the theistic people are so freaked out about the world that they think the only time things could be good was when the world would be destroyed and the good people would go to an infinite heaven. And then that seems like there's so many people they couldn't believe would ever reach there, they have to throw a whole bunch into the flames, you know. And these are distorted visions. I don't believe the great teachers really said these things or believed these things, because they were the incarnations of compassion and they wanted all beings to be happy and they saw the possibility of their happiness. That's where they got their energy, was from seeing the happiness in the fabric of the universe. And so all those condemnatory, horrible things are just people projection of their own paranoia about being uptown or downtown or being mayor or being a prisoner, you know, something like that. So then they project them into a cosmic level, you know.
Right. One of the great themes in your books is the idea of a renaissance that's emerging, a second renaissance,
mm-hmm.
and enlightenment culture. You use those words.
Yes.
And it implies that enlightenment is not an elite thing for a few select Buddhas
no.
or Christ, but it's meant for everyday people in a way.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Well, everyday people become less everyday if they become funny.
Right, but it's
they become, because they become much more cheerful, and they become much more helpful to others, and much more useful, really. And so everyone can do that. The human brain, I think, isn't it, some neuroscientists and some people have said, I hope maybe as a dogma that's now gone by, but I remember hearing it said, that we only use 7 or 8% of our brain. And the rest of it, then nobody knows what it's doing. It's on idle or something like that. And although I don't really believe that, they say the brain is redundant. You know, there's like, there could be much more things done. And it's a very funny thing, they say women's brains are more redundant than men's. You know, I read that. But I don't really believe that. What they are getting at by saying that is that in our ordinary shutdown state of feeling that we are so separate from everything and nervously maneuvering our way through this world of dangers and hostilities, we are not really opening up our full potential. And we are endowed with the possibility of awakening to our true nature, not depending on some scientist or Einstein or anybody. Being our own Einstein, everyone has this ability to be fully self-aware if they develop that ability, if they learn how to do that. And there are schools that teach people how to do that, and in more enlightened-oriented societies with enlightenment culture, those schools become the center of society. All the effort and energy, the kings support it, the merchants support it, the priests support it, the young people go there, and lots of people do open their minds that way, and those societies become more happy and less violent. None so far has become perfect, of course, and maybe none ever will become perfect, but I think the planet is being guided by enlightened beings toward a time when it will be more mainstream to be enlightened or to be focusing on enlightenment or developing enlightenment than it will be to be ignorant and confused and harmful to others. You know, I really do.
I like to explore this vision of enlightenment culture, you know, calling this from the wisdom traditions across different great teachings. What does it look like to you, enlightenment culture?
Enlightenment culture?
I'm thinking about education, politics.
Yeah. Well, for example, imagine if, say, all the Abrahamic traditions would get together and have a dialogue, and they would decide that God is really good and great and really wants to see human beings do well on earth and wants them to become God-like. That's his whole point, or her hope. Oh, no, I think Abrahamic's, it's his. So wants him to do that. And then they would say, okay, well, then we have to take care of the planet. Then you would have mullahs in the mosques, rabbis in the synagogue, ministers in the pulpit, preaching environmentalism. Clean up the street. You captains of industry, don't dump your stuff in the river. Don't pollute the world with your smokestack. In other words, you know, to respect your women, you know, take care of your children, etc. You would have all this kind of things, not just reading some scripture about how you're great because you believe in whatever I believe in, but actually carrying the teaching, operating like the Earth Institute, you know, operating like Al Gore, all the religious teachers. You would have a classroom in every temple and synagogue and church in the world. And this would be a radical thing. People would go to church not just to sort of reconfirm that maybe there's hope for me, I behaved really badly all week, but maybe I can pray and get absolution and then go back to behaving badly again next week. Instead of that, I'm going to learn how to behave better. Mm-hmm. And churches became more schools, and synagogues and mosques became more schools. They're not schools of be angry at the infidel and all this. So I think this is what we're called upon to do in this age. I think this is what the global consciousness, I think this is what the global lens should be showing people, that this is possible no matter what the religion, no matter what the culture, what the language. And this is the duty of all of the human beings to see the world. You know, I did love Buckminster Fuller. I know some poets who don't like him because they didn't like his jargon of his sort of scientific language. But I really like Buckminster Fuller because he had this idea that the world is not badly designed. You know, maybe he was a bit theistic, but he had a kind of mystical idea. The world is perfectly well designed for the human beings, and if they adapt to it properly and understand it, they will thrive on it. You know. And he accused all the world religions, and I agree with him, the way they're misunderstood, of giving people what he called an inferiority complex and thinking the world sucks, and you know we have to like kill off those ones, or we won't be able to manage. You know, and creating scarcity psychology, scarcity mindedness, and then making that a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, I think that's quite true, actually. And I think religions have to come around to being more pragmatic and really finding the heart in their traditions. Like in Jesus' case, love your enemy. He didn't say fight for Christianity and cleanse the world of non-Christians. He said love your enemy. Love doesn't mean go kill them, you know. Or even in your mind, send them to hell because they don't believe what you believe. And Muhammad had two different types of statements that some of the more critical Muslim thinkers say. The Mecca surahs are very light in peace and no compulsion in religion and whatever. And the Medina one, sometimes he gets a little riled up because a bunch of his followers were gets killed in a battle with somebody. So he gets a little distressed, you know, turbulent. There's some buffeting in those. And they should be considered less important than the Meccan ones when he's having his first revelations, you know. And there should be a little bit of a way of being critical, not instead of having to accept all of it exactly equal, even when they're contradictory. You know, there are some schools of Islamic analysis that do that.
Picking up on the Buddha's teaching and what you were just speaking about, it looks as if one core aspect of enlightenment culture is going to be deep respect for one another, sacred space.
Yes.
So we're living in sacred space.
Yes.
The earth is sacred.
Yes.
The relationship of the entire ecology.
Yes.
That seems to be a resonant of almost like the golden rule.
I think so.
Writ large.
The golden rule is important. Karen Armstrong and her compassion agenda is important. And in that context, the literate religions like Buddhism, Islam, you know, the textual, scriptural religions of the book, which is not just the Abrahamic, there's also a lot of books in Asia, they have to regain respect for different indigenous traditions that are non-literate, that are oral in their context, that are more aware of the custodianship and the involvement and engagement with nature. I think they have a lot to contribute as well. And I think it's very important to include them.
Well, now, Bob, you've been a professor 40 years, and so have I. And
I know, education, it's exhausting, isn't it? We're the same age.
I'd be ready to start.
I know, we can start, but it's, yeah, we can carry on.
No, but what I'm getting at is that education, especially so-called higher education, is where we reproduce the culture. And if what you're saying is we're faced at this moment of shift,
yes,
education is going to have to do some renovation.
Yeah, I believe so.
Talk about that. What would you see as a...
Well, the Dalai Lama said once, at the time of an honorary degree, that it's very important, in addition to producing a clever mind or clever brain, that education should help cultivate a good heart. And he wrote a nice book, composed of lectures he gave in a Christian monastery, called The Good Heart. And I think we don't do that enough. And one of the reasons I think we don't is because we have to refine further our concept of secular campus. I think actually secular campus is good, personally, in the sense that you don't want people competing and proselytizing religions on a campus. You want like separation of church and state. So you want religious studies, but it should be done like in a way of just helping people understand this kind of thought without trying to force any kind of indoctrination on them. Like, for example, people study Plato, and nobody accuses that philosophy professor of trying to get them to worship Apollo. And they teach Plato in a way where it's not connected to Plato and Socrates' own feelings about Apollo. But the brilliant way that they think and their analysis and everything, their wisdom, is what you're after. So I think the religious studies should be there, and the great spiritual traditions and the ethical traditions of the spiritual should all be taught, but not in a way of wishing to therefore sign people up in those traditions. You know? But we should have yoga in the schools where people learn how to handle their own bodies. Everyone should learn about how the body works, you know, the kidneys, the liver, not just pre-med people, everyone. You know, there should be mental yoga. People should learn to meditate, because meditation is an educational tool. It doesn't mean they should have to meditate on Buddha or Jesus or you know, Richard Dawkins or whatever. It doesn't mean they meditate on a particular thing, but they should learn how to do that. They do, after all, learn how to memorize formulas in science classes. They learn how to memorize Latin vocabulary in language classes, which are kinds of meditation. But they should also learn deeper knowledge of how their mind works, mindfulness, how the thoughts arise in the mind, how to choose, how to develop more control over your thought processes. They really need to learn how to relax also under stress, and how not to listen to yourself when you're in spirals of depression and things like that. That they would learn that if they would learn to meditate in a secular way, like John Kabat-Zinn teaches in hospitals, for example, lower the heart rate. There's all kinds of things like that that we should be introducing. I'm sure they will happen, actually, in school. And that way we would produce people, you know, in my college education and even in the colleges I teach in, students come in there and they hear about critical intelligence and they hear about compassion and they hear about decency and things like that at the invocation as freshmen and the graduation speech by the president. And in between, they don't hear about it. Critical intelligence, they do somewhat hear about during the humanities classes, but they don't hear really about decency, for example, ethics, and they don't really hear about, compassion and controlling their emotions and conquering their prejudices and racism and sexism and religious dogmatism and exclusivism, things like that. But these things should be consciously taught. The resilience of personality and character and the compassionate connection to others can be taught and should be taught. Without invoking particular religious, you know, dogmas that you have to, because actually you don't get those things just by believing in this religion or that. You have to cultivate them in your daily meditation.
Right. And so when people hear the word meditation, they don't often think of critical thinking.
Yeah.
And could you talk about that? Because
people wrongly think of, there are two kinds of meditation traditionally in Buddhism. That's what I'm finding. Two kinds of meditation. One is called shamatha, which means calming the mind and emptying it of thought and concentrating just on like a purple dot on the wall or something, or some image in your mind. That's called shamatha, and there are 9 stages of it, very elaborately taught, and you can develop your mind into a very much more powerful tool to concentrate on something. Your memory, you can cultivate a clarity of memory and a vividness of visualization and so forth, extraordinary, and depth of thought. And that's important, but that's not the most important. That just develops the mind into a more resilient tool and a fluent tool. But the most important type is what is called vipassana, or critical analytic meditation, where you you drive your mind toward some deep paradox or enigma, and you get deeper and deeper into it until you come up with an insight about its true inner workings or its nature. And there's a threefold process. And the first step is learning. You have to learn to think critically. You have to learn and think about, you know, like, I think this, what your and then reevaluate your preconceptions. And then second, you have to debate with others, actually. And that, this we don't have enough in our American classroom. They have more in Tibetan classrooms, a little bit better in England, and a little better in the Jewish classroom. Actually, the Shiva, they do a lot of debating based on scriptural interpretation, but still they debate. So the second one is reflection based on reflection, based on debating with others, where you get your emotions, like, you know, a dorm room debate, you know, like people have, but systematized, where it's part of your curriculum. And because why? Debating, you have to defend your view rationally, you have to listen to others' reasoning, you may see new aspects of things when another looks at it that you didn't think of, and then you get very emotionally engaged in that, so you get very heated up, and you work hard to defend your view, but if you do it right, you also are able to open your mind to another view by superior. If you encounter superior reasoning, you're not just completely dogmatic, repeating the same thing. And this then leads to the third type, which is meditative insight, where the analysis becomes so fast and so powerful in your mind that your mind then digs down into something to get to its real depth. And that's the most important type of meditation. That's where you have breakthroughs. That's where you understand the nature of the self. That's where you understand the nature of atoms, the nature of the world, and you'll have Einstein-like visions and understandings about the nature of things. And that's taking critical intelligence to the nth degree, combining it with one point of concentration, and building it up on critical reflection. And that's the way of getting enlightened.
So it's like good science.
It is science. All scientists should be trained in that, and they would make much better, they would have much better results, actually, and they would think of new experiments, and it would be extraordinary. It's kind of experiment. Meditation is kind of lab experiment with using your own mind as the lab. That's really what meditation is. It isn't just calming the mind, although, as I say, that's one kind, and that can be useful, but that's not the most useful.
So in a way, you're saying it's a technology that can get us more in touch with reality and the pulse of reality.
Exactly. And now there are interesting things with the neuroscientists where they are, you know, studying with the EEGs and fMRI machines and things like that. They're studying meditating people and noticing that areas of the brain are activated that normal people cannot activate by people who have certain degree of expertise in meditation. And this is creating confirmation of the value of these things. And this should therefore, for example, in an advanced degree in physics, the physicists should be trained to do this kind of meditation. Then they would be able to interpret these complex and subtle things with lasers and, you know, subatomic, you know, quantum things. They would be able to do much better with that. Okay. And even mathematics, they would improve their skill with mathematics.
Right.
For sure.
I'd like to shift gears a little bit, Bob, and take this out into the scene of the global crises on the planet.
Yes.
And this emerging second renaissance that you're speaking of.
Yes.
Enlightenment culture. Thinking of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, close
yes.
friend,
yes.
confidant.
Right.
He's a meditator.
Yes.
He is playing a role. Your recent book on the who is the Dalai Lama.
Yes.
Why does he matter?
Yes.
Let's talk about that for a moment, because
okay.
he could be a good embodiment of what we're talking about.
Well, in a way, the Dalai Lama, what he is he's kind of like the sort of supreme product, you could say, of the inner scientific tradition of the Tibetan Buddhists, which itself is the preservation of the inner scientific tradition of the great Indian universities that flourished for 1600 years, with no dark age, up until the beginning of the various Western invasions. It sort of set India back. Although now India has become free for about 50, 60 years, and they're beginning now to revive these traditions. But the great yogic sciences, you could say, of the Indians are a very precious thing to humanity, and that's where the Second Renaissance comes. The First Renaissance was the West's rediscovery of the Greek sciences, where they excelled in natural sciences, and the mathematics and geometry and natural sciences. And then the Second Renaissance comes from the rediscovery of the Indian sciences, where they excelled at psychology and yogic transformation of the mind and the emotions and the intellect and so forth, and generating intellect. Like, I was delighted, Nicholas Kristof wrote an editorial just the other day about how IQ is not at all fixed. And education should be aware that IQ can change drastically. People can gain 30 points in IQ by coming into a different environment, by studying and cultivating certain types of skills. And that it's not you're just born with some rigid, fixed brain, not at all. Brain is highly plastic. and you can increase intelligence. But we, in education, we just think we're going to give people information. We don't feel, we're not geared, sophisticated enough to say we're going to increase intelligence. So they'll be able to interpret information more deeply and better. And we should do that. And this is where the Indian sciences and the Buddhist aspect of those we get through Tibetan sciences can come. And the Dalai Lama is like a representative of that. He's a tremendous genius. He's a worldwide famous author. When scientists, when Nobel Prize winning scientists meet with him, they get new insights and they really flip out in dialogue with him, even though he comes from a completely different tradition. So this is sort of the meeting of the inner and the outer sciences, you could say. And it's really it's essential in our age, because 21st century, no more war, no more violence, technology has to return to cleaning up the planet, developing sustainable ways of living, no more just endless mass production of polluting toys and polluting objects and just consumerism. It's finished now. The planet cannot afford it, we cannot afford it, and it was unhealthy anyway. You know? So the Dalai Lama is someone who walks that talk to the extreme degree. He's the great master in his tradition. He has kept alive the institutions, and there are thousands more who are very much going in his direction, if maybe not to his extreme quality. He might say there are some greater than him who are just not famous, but you know, I think he's pretty amazing, actually, personally. He really is. And then, as an ethical teacher, like when he wrote his book called Ethics for the New Millennium, which is I'm very loved, and why the Dalai Lama Matters, I take up some of the themes in the Ethics for the New Millennium and push them a little further. When he wrote that, I liked it so much, and after I read it, I went to him and I said, okay, Holmes, I can see now you're ready to be a prophet to the world, not just to Tibet. And he maybe thought I meant by prophet predicting the future, which he disclaims doing, instead of the idea of the ethical prophet who challenges the unethical behavior of the society, you know, the global society. So he's truly a global figure. You know, another book about him by my friend Pico Iyer, a great writer, who you should get on the show, and if he ever gets in this area, he's really worth it. He's such a great guy. I just had a dialogue with him in Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a book called The Open Road, and in which he sort of presents the Dalai Lama as kind of the great leader of the global citizens, because he kind of is sympathetic and he identifies with all cultures and all people, and he shows that each culture has the potential of bringing out these good qualities in the human being, and you have to reinforce them. And he wants to lend any methodology from Buddhism without asking people to be Buddhist to help bring those good qualities out of whatever their culture is, which he has faith it's there in all people. Because he feels it's basic human nature is this kindness and wisdom and intelligence and so on. So Dalai Lama is absolute inspiration. And in that book, of course, I'm also very much engaged with one of the greatest problems of the 21st century, which is the meeting of the Chinese mass with the rest of the world. That's a huge thing. You know, there's overseas Chinese all over the place, but the big mother load of the Chinese is like a fifth of humanity. And then there all the, you know, the Russians, you know, all the sort of whiteys have a kind of subliminal thing about it, and there's a mutual racism. The Chinese think the whiteys are kind of weird and vice versa at a deeper level. Of course, people have friends and people are mixed, but there's a deep level there that's dangerous. And if China emerges, it continues to imitate the West, as it has imitated Western Marxism for some period. Now it's imitating Western laissez-faire, environmentally destructive capitalism, industrialization. And it's now threatening to imitate Western imperialism and colonialism and kind of like world conquest. They want 21st century to be China's century. And if they do that, and we'll have another war, you know, it will be the last case, the last plausibly frightening case of what I call industrial tribalism. And it will provoke tremendous backlash from everyone else, and it will be devastating to the planet. It will be the last really wrong turn on this planet. It could be doomsday for everybody, actually. And so bringing the Chinese into harmonious interconnection with the West, not just paternalistically as slaves to manufacture toys for Walmart, and not as a field to exploit their market, but as equals, them making great things and contributing them to the world, and we making things contributing to them, and harmoniously balanced, working together to solve poverty and other kinds of world problems, it's crucial that we do that. And of course, to do that is essential for them to turn around and develop a governance where they allow their own people to be more democratic, they stop being dictatorial with them, and they start being nice to their neighbors. Now, the person who's in the ideal position to help China begin this thawing process from a sort of paranoid, dictatorial procedure that they're involved in now is the Dalai Lama. And he wants to help them. He identifies with them. They claim he's a Chinese, because they claim Tibetans are, although Tibetans don't agree, but he's willing to try if they weren't oppressing the Tibetans. Mm-hmm. You know? So I show in this book how the problem between them is easily solved, how the Dalai Lama wants to be the best friend of the Chinese, how what he wants from them is easy for them to give the Tibetans is actually practical and money-saving for them, and what he wants to give to them is something that they really need, a spiritual rekindling, a relaxing ability to cooperate more rather than dominate, and even the worldly good of legitimate sovereignty in Tibet, which currently they don't have. They simply invaded, occupied, and are colonizing, and they don't actually have legitimate sovereignty because they invaded after the UN was founded, when you're not supposed to go and cross borders. And they pretend they've always owned Tibet, but it is not true. And the British know that it's not true. The Indians know that it's not true. Anybody who ever studied it, and they, the Chinese, know that it's not true. The leadership knows that. So the Dalai Lama wants to give Tibet to them if they would only make life pleasant for the Tibetans instead of oppressing the Tibetans.
So the way he models the kind of wisdom you're talking about, and global citizenship.
Global citizenship, that's right. And love your enemy, and be cooperative in dialogue with your enemy. He kept saying before the Iraq War, he said, Saddam Hussein is a danger, you're afraid? Talk to him, what does he want? What does Saddam Hussein want? Do you think he wants to obliterate the United States? I don't think so. He doesn't want to obliterate anybody. Well, what does he want? Does he want Israel to be nicer to the Palestinians? Yes. Well, why don't they be nicer to them? That's okay. You know? Does he want to obliterate everybody? No. If you talk to him. Or if he does, you know, maybe make a video game for him to go around obliterating people for world obliteration, and Donald Trump can play it all day long. You know, but don't blow up the entire country and kill 1.3 million Iraqis and make 7 million homeless. Talk to them. Talk to them. There's no more defeating any enemies. When you attack enemies, you defeat yourself.
In your book, there's a very optimistic note, ironically. I know there's a Chinese saying that crisis is also opportunity.
That's true.
And it sounds as if you feel that despite the outer appearance, that there may be even a possibility of a reconciliation.
Absolutely.
Talk about that.
Wow. Well, I go so far as to promise President Hu Jintao a Nobel Peace Prize for his very own. Yeah. If he would be kind and nice to Dalai Lama and accept the Dalai Lama's hand of friendship, and then work together to solve all the problems between them, and between the Chinese people and the Tibetan people, that is, because the problems are not just personal. They have to do with the bad and unhappy state of the Tibetan people, because of the guy who they currently have ruling the party boss in Tibet, who's doing like a cultural revolution and trying to suppress Tibetan religion again, which is the one thing the Tibetans really don't like. And so they're going to be really upset about that, no matter what material goods may be handed. And actually, they're not really handing material goods. They're developing Tibet for them to colonize, is what they're doing, the money they're spending there. They're not developing it for the Tibetans to be wealthy or to be prosperous. They are not wealthy, they are very deprived, the Tibetans. It's in second class, like an apartheid thing they're doing there. So I offer him a Nobel Peace Prize. And I say, the reason I'm saying I offer it is that if he did this, and if he solved this problem and showed a different face of China, how China could be gentle. You know, in other words, China that wants the world to trust it. Tibet is in the palm of China's hand. So far, the Chinese, anything they've had in their hand, they crush it. Because they want to dominate it. It can't show any wiggle of independence. Like the Falun Gong went to pray in front of Jiang Zemin's house, he crushed it. You know, the Christians want to be Christian without the state-approved type of Christian church. They want to be loyal to the Pope, the Catholics. They crushed them. They crushed the Tibetans. The Tibetans want to have the Dalai Lama, they crushed them. Now they have Tibet in the palm of their hand. Let it thrive on the palm of their hand. Let them be happy. Let them have the Dalai Lama. Why are they afraid of this monk? You know, then the world would trust them because they had power over something, but they were gentle with it when they had power over it. That's someone you can trust.
It's a great moment, isn't it?
Right? Yeah. It would be a great thing for them. And then, naturally, I mean, they gave de Klerk, who was a horrible apartheid guy, a Nobel Peace Prize because he changed and he talked to Mandela. They didn't just give it to Mandela, they gave it to de Klerk too. Dalai Lama's not going to get a Nobel Prize. He already got one. So who would get the second one for the Chinese? And then he claims Dalai Lama's a Chinese citizen, then they had two. And my whole point is that Dalai Lama, I know the process of the Nobel Prize, and the former Nobel Prize winners are the main nominators. And all of the gang, Tutu, would jump up and down with joy. And he would co-nominate, and so would Mandela, and so would Wiesel, and so would Betty Williams, and so would Gorbachev. They all would. And then Hu Jintao could be a Gorbachev without having to lose the Baltic states and the Ukraine. Because what the Dalai Lama wants to give Hu Jintao, once he has all his people free on their plateau again, is he wants to hold a plebiscite, and then he wants to campaign with his people to vote, to voluntarily join the Chinese Union. And a plebiscite is the only legitimate way of gaining sovereignty over a country that you didn't own in the past. They would vote to join. And you know, that might be thought of as a risk, because they've been horrible to the Tibetans for 50 years, so maybe the Tibetans wouldn't do that. But if the Dalai Lama campaigned, of course they would. Dalai Lama is like almost as good as Obama. Everybody will vote for him if he would run, if he would campaign for them to vote some way. And then it would, so he would be a world celebrity like Gorbachev. He could go to conferences like Gorbachev. He could be on your radio show like Gorbachev. Hu Jintao could. And yet he wouldn't lose territory. Gorbachev is a little, the Russians look down on him because he lost the Ukraine, they feel, and the Baltics and the Kazakhstan, a lot of property. But this guy wouldn't lose anything. And then the Tibetans in a free Tibet, but in a Chinese Union, they would make it into a jewel again. People would go there like crazy. It would be, make a tourist mecca. They would go to ski. They would go to do sanatorium, take Tibetan medicine, go to hot spring. We could have a peacemaking branch of the UN there in Lhasa because Tibetans are good mediators and they're peaceful people. It would be totally fabulous for the Chinese. And I even proposed a bank, like Swiss Bank, where all the corrupt Chinese officials could have numbered accounts in Tibet.
This is, well, our time is just about
up. Oh, okay.
I'd like to just think about pulling the themes together.
And yes.
I invite you to reflect, because there's so much optimism coming out of your books and your teaching and your vision for where we
yes.
are in this emerging renaissance and in
yes,
culture.
Well, it's all reason, you
yes.
know.
I'd like to hear.
Emotionally, I'm just as miserable and terrified as everybody else.
See.
And I'm raised in America to think that something's going to go wrong and things won't work out, you know, like we all expect. And also, I'm a chicken-hearted, and so I like to think, well, I don't need to do this or that because it won't work anyway. You know, like we're cynical and we're not activists when we could be, because we use the excuse that it really won't help, you know. Why only 50% of the American electorate votes until this time when Obama got some new people out there? Because they're brainwashed to think that they have no power, and they can use the excuse of cynicism to think, well, therefore my vote won't count, so it won't matter. And this is absolutely wrong. My wife constantly harangues me because she's Swedish, and she's dual citizen, but Swedish on the other side. And the Swedes, 98% vote every election. It's only vote because they were in Europe where they had a big world war, so they know that the governments can be really bad. So everybody votes always. In Germany, France, they really do. In England, they vote. And we should get back to voting. We will have better governments. You know, we will have less Rush Limbaugh-tainted fanatics and things like that. We'll have better things. So we should throw, but I myself, therefore, fear emotionally. But logically, we have to recognize that this planet is in a special moment. And this moment demands that we finally listen to the great teachers that have been teaching us since 2,500 years. And some have listened, and unfortunately, often the rulers have not. And now it's time the rulers do have to listen to these people. Mm-hmm. And if we do, we will demilitarize very definitely. We will rebuild our schools. We will take care of our poor. We will take care of our sick. And we'll be able, and we're really able to do that, and there will still be profit enough in these benevolent enterprises and creative enterprises. There will be profit enough for people to be quite, quite wealthy. Mm-hmm. Nobody really, look at Bill Gates. He got $120 billion or something like that, and it made him miserable. And now he's only getting a little relief by starting to give it away. You know, what was the point, sitting there being miserable? And like, luckily he found Melinda, and now she's helping him give it away, and every billion he loses, he feels better. And then the poor guy, Warren Buffett, dumps another $40 billion on him. He's got to get that away. So he's like desperately trying to like shovel it off so he can feel better. It's just, you know, it's a potlatch thing. You don't feel that good. You have billions and hundreds of billions. You don't need it. No one needs that. It makes you nervous. You're going to lose it, and some rival's going to come and take it, and you just get indigestion. Well, that's my slogan. You know, in the back of this book, I have a slogan, which is my favorite slogan now, and people have mixed feelings about it, actually. They're not so sure it's a great slogan, but anyway, I like it. Anyway, it's under a thing in the back called 10 Points of Hope.
Yes.
And the 10th point says, therefore, it is our duty and obligation to cultivate hope. We can free our imaginations from being stuck in the expectation of failure. We can free any enemy from expecting that he or she cannot become a friend. We can follow the Dalai Lama and never give up. We live in hope as the realistic way to live. We live, therefore, without bitterness, joyfully and happily, while vigorously opposing violence and injustice. It is our duty to strive to live so happily that even if someone kills us, we will die happy.